Hi Nate, welcome to the show. Thanks for having you as a guest today. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jeff. I'm excited.
Good, great. What we really want to get to know from you today is, you're obviously kind of well known for your marathon running. Obviously, you've had a lot of success. So we want to have you on the show today so you can teach our readers about, what they can do if they kind of hit that plateau in their marathon training, if they're been struggling to break 3 hours for the last couple of years, some advanced tips and tricks that they can use. Also just some of the marathon basics that a lot of the beginners can go through, including, how to handle their nutrition, what types of gels, waters, those types of things they should be using, going through some of the long runs and the specific workouts that you like to do. So we're going to cover all that in the interview today. And so to get started, I want to just have you talk a little bit about your progression from, I guess, probably what many would call a mediocre high school career. Nothing, you weren't a, all-American high school runner, and then to a pretty good college runner, but nothing that would suggest that, you're ready to run at the elite level. And then again, kind of moving into your progression as an elite runner, and your success at the marathon trials and the marathon in general. So just let me kind of talk to me about that progression a little bit.
Sure. Like you said, I was a decent but not exceptional high school runner. I was good on the local level. I think today, with how good high school kids have gotten, I would have been really far down the totem pole or whatever. But
Yeah, I feel the same way about my own high school career.
I
I
know
thought I was pretty good, and now it's like I would, wouldn't even
it's
be
scary,
close to
and
anything
it's funny
good.
because I can remember in high school looking at results from the late 70s and saying, "Oh my God, these guys were insane. How deep were things? State meets were so much better." Now, I think these kids look back like, "Oh, what was the big deal with the late 70s?" They're really running well. So, but anyway, I ran a high school program that just I think wasn't a bad program, but it didn't work for me. It was a lot of intervals, a lot of speed, and not a lot of long term. So I ran very well quickly. I had good times as a eighth grader, who's a junior senior high. But I didn't progress much up until my senior year, and at that point I started doing some more miles, and I think I may have even done one 90-mile week on April vacation or something like that. But for the most part, maybe 60, 70 miles a week, which doesn't seem that high, but at that time there weren't a lot of kids really pushing volume, so it's a
Yeah,
little
that's pretty high for a kind of a high school runner.
for a high school runner. I know every once in a while now, you'll see an article about a high school kid running 100, exceptional high school kids running 100 miles a week or something like that. There was, at least that I saw, nothing around there at that time of kids doing that. So I went to college, and at that point, I'd improved more between my junior and senior year of high school than I had in the previous 3 years. And I
Okay.
really attributed that to, hey, you upped your miles, you got faster. So I went a little crazy with it. And I had a college coach who was okay with high mileage. He was kind of old school, and he was kind of old. So we, he let me kind of go wild, and then he started to realize I was getting a little out of control and tried to get me to back off, and I just did secret runs and all this stuff. So I think I went home for Christmas break and I did like 126 or 127 mile a week, which is a lot,
And
and
this
it
is your
was
freshman year in college.
awesome.
And this is your freshman year in college?
Freshman year in college, yeah,
Wow.
first fall, and yeah, that was about the end of my season at that point. My shins started hurting that week. Within a couple of weeks, I couldn't really walk on them. I tried to keep running while I was on crutches the rest of the day for a little stretch. That didn't work too well. So then college became sort of a series of that, of sort of me touching the stove, burning myself, and then waiting a little bit and saying, maybe I can touch that hot burner again, you know? So I only competed in two full seasons. In my first 3 years of college, out of a possible nine.
Wow. I think that's a interesting lesson for probably a lot of our readers who, really struggle with everybody tells them to run faster, you need to run more mileage. And then they try to run more mileage and then they get hurt. And, there's that tough juxtaposition there. So it's good to hear that you went through that same struggle yourself, as an athlete with doing the same thing. And you were young too, you're not like you were 40, 35,
I
40 years
wasn't
old.
37 or 47 or 57 trying to up my mileage. And I do think that the big thing is you have to do things in an intelligent manner and at your own pace. And if you do build intelligently, there's no limits. I hate to hear someone say, "Oh, well, I tried 60 miles a week and I got hurt. I can't do 60 miles a week." Well, you couldn't, but maybe you've done 2 years of 45 miles a week since, and you're that much stronger. So then my second college coach came in, and him and the last coach had a really nice transition, and they sort of worked together to get me under control. And I had a year where the only goal was to stay healthy for the year.
Mm-hmm.
And there were times I was training hard. I mean, I had a couple of 100-mile weeks in that year, but mm-hmm. I had a stretch in the winter where I think I was running about 35 miles a week. And I was hurt, and I was just sore and banged up, and just, but they got me through without any significant time off.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran a lot faster. I had been managing through a lot of cross training and through decent training while I was healthy mm-hmm. over the previous years. I'd gotten a little faster since high school. I probably ran about 16 flat for 5K at the end of high school. And now I've gotten down to, I think, 15:20.
Okay.
But at the end of this year of staying healthy, I ran a little under 15 minutes, which for me was a big barrier. I sort of looked at 15 minutes as being good training and good training shape. You're right. Good enough to train with people,
right.
Sort of thing. And then I went home. I got a good sensible. At that point, I was ready for a summer of 90 to 110 miles a week, and I got that in. And I came back the next year, again, training more sensibly. I mean, I'm still pushing it a little bit and getting banged up time, but I ended up running a lot better that year, and I qualified for Division II Nationals, which is nothing like qualifying for Division I Nationals. But for me at the time, that was the goal. That was a big step.
Right.
And I had now been healthy for more than a year and was really doing well. And I'd run, I think I ran 14:31 for 5K. So in about a year and a half, 18 months, a little bit less, I'd gone down about a minute in my 5K, which was the event I was running more often than not at that point, and that I had legitimate PRs to look at. I think I took two and a half minutes off my 10K time in the same period, but the 10K going in was, I knew it was a soft PR. It wasn't representative of fitness. So then...
I'm sorry, just to interrupt real quick.
Yeah.
So you kind of attribute more of the success that you had in that latter stage of your college career to more the consistency as opposed to, hard, crazy workouts or, mileage.
A lot of times I speak at summer camps, and the thing I always tell the kids is, in the microcosm of going home and training for the summer, the kid who goes home, if you take two identical twins with the exact same genetic makeup and one of them goes home and for the 14 weeks at home, he averages 30 miles a week for the whole summer and gets it in. And the other twin does the same exact number of miles, but he packs it all into the last 3 weeks of the summer. The one who did the 30 a week all summer will be better in the fall. Consistency is more important than, I think, anything else in the sport. If you can manage to run consistently and to touch on as many different of your systems as possible consistently, mm-hmm. you're going to improve. So definitely, I think getting consistent was the best thing that ever happened to me. And it's also easier mentally. When you're hurt and you're healthy, you're running well, you're excited, everything falls apart, it's a tough thing. So then I
want to expand on that just a little bit more. So in terms of that consistency, you said you had a new coach that came in, and was he pretty instrumental in holding you back? What was the kind of that trigger that finally was like, stopped you from burning your hand on the stove, all the time?
I think I had taken about all I could take of failing and of getting hurt. So that had broken down my stubbornness a little bit. I think the combination of my original old coach, George Davis, who's a very good coach, having been telling me this for 4 years and now transitioning in, and Gary Gardner, who's a new coach, who's an excellent coach, he's still at UMass Lowell, kind of coming in and saying the same things. And then Gary dealt with me better as a person. Me and Gary get along tremendously well. He understood me a lot better. I mean, Gary was in my wedding. And so he really was able to kind of talk to me in a way and make me understand things. And we've always had a good sort of back and forth, and I think that was really, really important. But I think hearing it again and again was starting to sink through. I tend to be thick-headed to the extreme. So sometimes it just takes me a little longer to pick up on things than it does for most people. But yeah, so I had a year left of grad school, and I just decided I wanted to find out what I could do. And I was really excited about Arthur Lydiard, and I tried to do a perfect Lydiard year. This was my plan, and I was going to break through and win Olympic medals.
Just real quick, again, sorry, just for our audience members who don't know, Just briefly, you know, 1 or 2 minutes, what does an Arthur Lydiard system look like? You know, what are the principles?
A big base, you know, you're looking at about 10, 12 hours a week of steady running plus some extra easy running mixed in for, you know, maybe 16 or even 24 weeks. Then a hill phase where he did a lot of hill bounding and springing and that sort of thing. Then he would do, and that was maybe 4 weeks, and then he'd do 4 to 6 weeks of a lot of anaerobic work, and then sort of another 4 weeks of sort of bringing it all together with more race-specific type workouts, and then a period of about 6 weeks with almost no, what we would call training, you know, like just basically you're racing a lot, you're doing a lot of strides, and your mileage is down from where in the base you might total mileage be doing 160 miles a week. You'd be down running like 30 or 40 miles a week.
Okay, so kind of a big pyramid.
Big pyramid, exactly. Okay. And I kept doing the base, and then I would hurt my IT bands trying to do one of the exercises he liked for the hill phase was downhill sprinting. And for whatever reason, that didn't line up with my my IT bands at all.
Okay.
It's just an exercise. I've tried it since. It always agitates me, but I insisted on. And then I would miss, I wouldn't miss much time. I'd miss 2 or 3 days, or I'd have to run light for a week, and I would lose all my confidence and decide I need to go back to the beginning. And so I restarted this base phase about 3 times.
Wow.
And so if you sort of fast forward now, it's been more than a year. I finished up grad school, and I've decided that I'm just going to keep the part-time jobs I have to try to take a shot at getting a marathon qualifier. And in this long extended base phase, I've averaged about 145 miles a week for about 18 months. And I've run, you know, 30, 40 for 10K, which is good for me. I think I ran a 14:35 road 5K, which I knew was kind of a little bit better than my track best. And I thought, you know, I'll give the marathon one try. But I also knew I kind of needed to come up with a different plan in terms of getting marathons ready for a marathon, because Lydiard's guys, if you look at their times in the track, on the track, they were, would still be at least national class today. If not even world class, certainly at 800, 1500 meters. But his marathoners, though he had Olympic medalists in the marathon, their times weren't anything up to the standard of the other events. You know,
okay.
I think Barry McGee ran 216, 217. And when you compare that to other guys, his coaching guys in the 1320s, high 27s for 10K, you know, 144, it just didn't line up.
Right.
And so I ended up finding a Renato Canova schedule for Rogers Roth, and I did my normal Lydiard base, and about 10 weeks out from my marathon tried to do this schedule with the times adjusted for me. And what I found out is that Rogers Roth, a 208 marathoner in New York City, could recover a whole lot better even when I adjusted the efforts to line up to me. And so I had about a 12-week cycle of workouts where I was supposed to be going hard 2 or 3 times a week, where I managed out of, I've counted up, and it was like 21, 22 planned workouts, and I completed 3.5.
That's not a good ratio.
No, it wasn't a good ratio, but I did all the moderate work in there that I was supposed to do, which was something, I had 2 speeds prior to this, where I just went hard for a workout, or I went easy for an easy run. Now, with the Canova stuff, there was some stuff that was sort of in between. It was a session that was, it was definitely harder than you'd want to go on an easy day, but you could still do it again the next day. It wasn't,
right,
it wasn't a workout. And it clicked for me. The combination of the base I had going into it, finally doing something to wake up some of these systems, and I raced twice during the specific phase. I did a 3K on the track, and it was horrible. I had worked out 2 days before, and I remember trying to put the spikes on, and my feet were shaking. After the warm-up, I was so tired and fatigued, and I still managed to run the second or third fastest 3K I'd ever run, and I was kind of like, oh, that was all right, but I've been working so hard, I sort of expected more, and the workouts that I had gone through had been much, much better than I expected. And then I went down and did the 3M half marathon, and I ran a huge PR. I took about 4 minutes off my half marathon best.
Wow.
I remember setting my 8K and 10K best sort of en route during the race, and looking at the clock just sort of in disbelief, like, how can I be running that kind of a time feeling easy? And so at that point, I sort of realized this stuff is the direction I need to head in. And I ended up running my debut marathon a few weeks after that, and I ran 2:15, which at the start of the cycle, my half best was 107:30 something. So I basically took my half marathon and doubled it in an 8-week phase.
Wow.
8-12 week phase.
So during that specific phase that you were talking about, you said you were having a hard time hitting the really high quality workouts, but you were still kind of getting in the moderate type stuff.
Yeah, and I did hit, like I said, I did three very solidly of the high intensity workouts. But the thing was, it took me, where on the Rogers Rob schedule, he was doing one or two of these a week.
Okay.
Of these really, and I'm for example, one of the workouts that I actually did do, I did a 10K tempo run in the morning. I warmed up 2-3 miles. I did 10K light tempo, about 34 minutes.
Okay.
I took a 5-minute standing break, and then I did another 10K tempo in 31:40. Which my goal for that was to actually run about 32:50. I was looking for 2:20 marathon pace, and I only had markers every mile. And by the time I hit the mile, I was well ahead of that, and I just felt good. So I was like, "Well, this is just a good rhythm. I'll probably come apart." But I didn't come apart. So then that becomes like, okay, maybe that is goal marathon pace if I could do that. But then I cooled down. I went to work. I came home from work and did the second half of the workout, which is another warm up, another 10K tempo in about 34 minutes. I think that one was like 33:50, and then I was supposed to do 10 by 1,000 at 3 minutes, and I did the first 9, averaged 3 minutes, and the last one the wheels came completely off, and I ran like 3:13 or something. But at that point, you've run, I cooled like a mile down back to the house, and I actually almost fell down trying to walk up the stairs. My legs were so
Can
wobbly,
imagine.
but it was 40 kilometers of really good effort running, along with another 6-7 miles of easy, maybe even 8 miles of easy running thrown in there in a single day. Now, I believe on the schedule I had copied, I was supposed to go hard again maybe 6 days later or 4 days later, and it took me about 2.5 weeks to
Wow.
fully recover from that effort. But I think that, yeah, doing the moderate sessions and allowing my body to actually recover from the big efforts, it really unlocked areas of my fitness that I had not touched on.
Yeah, and I think you kind of have two great points in that or not story, but that phase of training in terms of how we can relate it to the audience that are training, because obviously they're not going to be able to do a
Yeah, I don't
double.
assign that one to many people.
Right. I can imagine. But I think there's two important points there, and one, I think in marathon training, and you can tell me how you feel about this, but I tell people that they don't, in marathon training, you're not going to hit every workout perfectly because you're carrying over that fatigue, and carrying that fatigue is an important part of the training, and it's hard, it's a kind of a hard concept to grasp that you're still making progress and it's still a good workout even if you didn't hit the goal. Do you find that to be the same?
Yeah, 100% true. I never had a cycle where I hit all the workouts. I'd have stretches, maybe 3 or 4 weeks, but it's so hard to schedule it perfectly because you do need these workouts to really take you to the edge of fatigue. It's not like a 5K where you need to get up that lactic acid, or you need to get the 5 kilometers of work at pace in that sort of thing. You need to prepare yourself for the final 10 kilometers, and that's going to be a point where your body is shutting down. So you need to do these workouts where you're shutting down. And with your general volume up high, you may think that it's going to take a 30-kilometer run to shut your legs down, and you're too tired going in. It only took 20 kilometers.
Right.
Well, just because the workout wasn't what was scheduled, you got the job done. You ran as hard as you could, and you were hitting the pace, at least for a time. And then also in terms of recovery off of it, I think a lot of times people see what someone who does, some of my schedules, when I was really clicking, I might do 7 or 8 very hard workouts in a 6 week buildup to a marathon with maybe 10 smaller medium efforts mixed in there. Frankly, if you're in 3 hour marathon shape, which is good shape, you're not going to be able to do that. You're not going to recover off of that thing. That comes
Right.
with years of background. Much like I'm not going to recover off of workouts like some of these guys who've run 204 or 203. Their fitness it's been taken to another level, and you don't just do your workouts faster, but you recover from the same effort quicker.
Right. Yeah, that was going to be actually my second point was, adjusting and adapting the recoveries, because I think, one of the problems with using, I'll call them generic marathon schedules, in the sense of, this day, this day, this day, is that everybody recovers at a different rate, and that's going to be based on your pace, your individual you know, recovery rate. Some people just recover faster.
Yeah.
And then your age, obviously, the older you get, the longer it's going to take. And I think adjusting those recovery times is really important. And so I think it's, I think it's great. I mean, I think it's a great example of how you took that schedule and realized right, kind of quickly that, wow, I'm not going to be able to recover for this, and made those adjustments to be able to get in the work and to make sure the important workouts got in, even if, you know, you weren't killing them. So I think that's a great point that you brought up.
Yeah. And I mean, some of it was doing a good job. Some of it was some good advice from Gary, who was still, he was kind of helping with this experiment. And some of it was just dumb luck. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I had a number of workouts that I tried to start, and I would go out there like, no, I'm ready. I'm recovered. I'm going to be able to do 6x5K at 15:50 or 16 flat. No problem. Mm-hmm. And I do one. And it was all out and my day was over.
Yeah.
So, but if you listen to your body, even if you're a little slow on the uptake with it, like I was, you can get through and learn a lot from it.
Yeah. So when you kind of struggled with those workouts in the marathon cycle, I guess there's two things. You know, I know a lot of people do struggle with that. How did you bounce back mentally and still kind of have that confidence? Like, wow, I can run well. And it has, you know, I guess probably over time that's changed because you've done it so many times. There's just that inbuilt confidence. You're like, you have a lot of years to look back and say, you know, I'm used to this. But for the beginning, marathoners, you know, how can they tell, like, you know, the difference between, or how can they boost their confidence mentally if they're not hitting their workouts and kind of going from there? Did you have any struggle with that, or?
Yes. I mean, I've always struggled with, I shouldn't say always. I think from about age, once I finished up high school and didn't become a star, I started to struggle with my confidence a lot. And, I always had a lot of doubts, and definitely one of the things that was great about the marathon workouts was after succeeding in the first one and realizing, okay, you only need a couple of decent workouts to really show that you're ready. That gave me great confidence. I think that one of the things that all American runners could really use to learn from the Africans is you're not as good as we have a mentality, you're as good as your last race, you're as good as your last workout, you're as good as yesterday. And you talk to these Kenyan guys, that's bullshit as far as they're concerned. They mm-hmm. think you're as good as your greatest day, even if you haven't had it yet.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important when you look at a training block and you're trying to figure out what you should race, don't look at the bad days. Look at the best days. You are looking for a maximum effort in your race. Look at what your maximum workout effort was. Now, you still can learn from the bad days. It's important to see, okay, you're tired. Maybe I need to change things up and move things around to accomplish something. But in terms of what your potential race performance is, you need to only key in on your best workouts.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to rest up for a race. We're not going to have you run 70 miles a week going into a marathon and taper to 70 miles a week. You're going to rest. You're going to come in fresher. You're going to have one of your better days.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's important for the confidence. Sometimes you just have to have faith in the people around you telling you, oh, okay, it's good. Confidence is one of those things that without it, you're up a creek. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have it, it's hard to get it. I'm a big believer in fake it till you make it. this is a non-running story. When I was in college, I couldn't buy a date. I mean, I could not buy a date to save my life. And everybody said it's all about confidence. And I was like, confidence? How am I supposed to be confident? I haven't had a date in, you know, a couple of years. I can't. And I ended up reading this, like, really trashy book about how to get a date and how to, you know, become like a ladies' man, you know? Mm-hmm. And the whole thing was about, it's not about actually being confident, just present confidence and how you do that. And, well, lo and behold, I thought this was a total bunch of BS, but I started being more confident. I started getting some dates. And then the confidence slowly, you realize you're not faking it as often anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes real confidence. I follow a bunch of stupid little rules. And they seem silly, but they come so ingrained that it's really good. When you're talking about an upcoming race, never say anything negative. Don't allow negativity in. If someone says to you, man, looks like it's going to be hot on Saturday for the marathon, you say, well, it'll be easy to stay loose. Always turn everything into a positive. And the thing is, it's not that turning into a positive is necessarily going to help you, but turning anything into a negative will hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
because you're going to have times in your training cycle, you're going to have times in your race where it's not going well. You're going to have a bad patch. And if you're not sure at that point that it's going to go well, you will pack it in. It's going to happen. You will break. And there's no shame in it. It's just, it's going to happen. But if you can turn things into a positive and say, yeah, it's 16 miles in, I'm hurting, it's okay, I've hurt like this before. Yep. You know, I should be hurting. It's been 16 good miles. And make everything into a positive, or at least a neutral. It goes a long way. And yeah, sometimes it's fake it till you make it. You don't have to necessarily believe it. Even though you're lying to yourself,
right?
It's still, it can help you, you pick it up a little bit.
Yeah, that's a great tip. I think a lot of people could use that, especially in terms of, you know, fake it till you make it, you know, and turning all those negatives, you know, never let the negatives creep in your head. That's a great great little tip.
Yeah, I think it's one of those small things that everybody can do, and you can carry over into almost anything. And it seems silly, but there's so much negativity out there. I think particularly in running, that people are very down on themselves. It's a humbling sport.
Yeah.
So I think it's easier to see your own limitations. But also I think a lot of, you go on a Let's Run message board sometime and you can see the best in the world just getting ripped, you know, absolutely ripped apart. And I think that you need to approach it with a different mentality. If you don't believe you can do it, you can't. Yeah. Now, just because you believe you can do it, it may not be enough to get you there, but it's one of the prerequisites. It's required. Yeah, so start believing.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. It's funny. I have logs of all my training runs since I was in high school. And I used to write them in little graphing notebooks. And I'll go back and read some of them. And it's amazing how depressing and negative I am about my own training. And it's just, I read them now and I look back and I'm like, was I like completely depressed? Like I read them and I think like I was going to jump off a cliff. And, you know, I even had pretty good workouts and I'd be like, that workout sucked. Like, couldn't hit the last repeat.
Yeah.
And it was so negative. And I read something that you wrote for our site about your own training. And you said that you never try to put something negative in your log.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting because it was such a juxtaposition to what most of my logs looked like, which were like, felt like crap, you suck. And you went so far as to say, like, if I did put that I felt really bad or that I was something negative, like it must have been really bad. And I thought that was interesting. I thought that was a good play on kind of yourself looking back, especially if you look back on your logs to gain confidence from your workouts to race well.
Yeah, it's interesting. And funny, my high school logs look exactly like yours. same thing. And early college logs, same thing. It didn't matter. I remember I did 20 by 400 like my freshman year in college and managed to run them all in 70, which at the time, I wasn't just the best workout of my life. It was probably the best running effort of any kind of my entire life. And I got beat up pretty bad on the last two 400s by the kid I was doing the workout with. He was able to drop a couple 65s. And that's what my comments were about in the log.
Right.
I was talking about, like, I need a kick. I need to find a finishing kick. I can't even finish workouts, you know. And then, yeah, I did. I made that a new rule and sort of changed. And it's funny, reading my build up to the Olympic trials in 07, which was my best race by far ever, I had a bunch of things kind of go wrong in August and September as I was starting to head into the most sort of the meat of the preparation. Everything had gone really well from about February, March on. And then I hurt my Achilles and missed 4 or 5 days, but thought I was going to miss more. Really was a surprisingly quick turnaround. And then I came back a little quick and I sort of hurt an abductor muscle, and you know, it was another couple of days setback. And then I got a good workout in and I got food poisoning.
Wow.
So this is 2007. I hadn't thrown up since 1992. And I was throwing up for 2 days. So for me, that was like,
wow.
Everything, as I'm going through this cycle, every comment, when I look back on it, it's amazing, because you're now looking at 4, 5, 6 weeks where I should be having my best training and I've had zero good workouts.
Mm-hmm.
And every comment is, yes, had to abort today's workout because of stomach illness, but feeling good for the part I did, really fit, just need a couple and everything will be okay.
Uh-huh.
And it was just this continual theme of, yep, mileage has been low for the last month, doesn't matter. The mileage for the months before was great. Everything's coming around, you know, just need a couple of workouts. And there was this just sort of expectation that it was going to be okay and having my head in the right place. And looking back, reading the log, it's very surprising to me because I was struggling with a lot of different things and I was having a really bad stretch in my personal life. And you would not, if you read this log, you would think it was the greatest 2 months of my life in every way. So it is. It's important. And I think, too, when you are training hard, it's easy to be tired and sore and down all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you start writing that as comments, yeah, you're going to look back and it's definitely going to look like you were suicidal. And people are going to be like, why do you run? And it's like, well, listen, most of it's great. You're just really, really tired. And you generally fill out the log at the end of the day.
Right, right. No, those are great points. I'm glad you opened up about that. I think that's a great lesson that people can learn and use, you know, over and over in their own training. So kind of moving forward, I want to, I guess, talk a little bit about, you know, marathon specifics, getting into some specific workouts and that kind of thing. So, you know, kind of starting at the beginning, how do you first start constructing a marathon plan? Do you start with your long runs? Do you start with the mileage? You know, where do you start? Where do you kind of look to, you know, how do you kind of start building something like that?
I see the marathon in two separate ways. For a first-time marathoner who's looking just to finish, it's all about building the distance.
Mm-hmm.
So I construct everything around the idea of building the ability to continue to run for 26 miles. Pace is irrelevant. It's just about building your general fitness and building your time on your feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so in their case, it's a count back from how much time do we have before the race, and how are we going to sensibly build you up to the point where you can run either 2 10-mile runs in a day or an 18 to 20-mile single run, so that I feel confident that you can go into the marathon, that the rest and the adrenaline will get you the extra 10K,
mm-hmm.
And you can finish feeling as strong as one can feel.
Right.
Finishing something like that. I mean, no one finishes the marathon thinking, I'll just run back to the start to get that hat I threw on the ground. It's, you know, not like that. But for everybody else, once you start, time becomes a relative factor. Everything is focused entirely around specific pace workouts. The marathon, in terms of your max potential, is like every other event from 3K up. It's based on your lactic threshold, you know, your ability basically to process oxygen as efficiently as possible and process any acid that comes into the blood out, and
mm-hmm.
great. But the thing that makes the marathon different is that if you're not efficient enough at those paces, you'll come apart even though your fitness indicates a much better performance,
mm-hmm.
because you run out of glycogen.
Mm-hmm.
And so by running different workouts that are focused on your goal pace, and it has to be a sensible goal pace that lines up with your other times and your date fitness.
Right.
But by doing workouts that are tagged directly on that, you can teach your body to basically burn more fat at the same pace as you would. You know, a lot of times you talk to a runner and they're like, I did a 30-mile long run and I felt strong at the finish.
Mm-hmm.
How come 22 miles into the race, you're telling me I'm running out of fuel, and that's why I'm running 10-minute mile pace, 12-minute mile pace, 15-minute mile pace, instead of the sixes or sevens I was aiming for,
mm-hmm.
over the last 4 or 5 miles? And the thing is, when you're walking, 60-70% of the fuel you're burning is fat. When you're sprinting, 90% of the fuel you're burning is carbohydrate, glycogen.
Mm-hmm.
You want to, and then it's sort of a, you know, a curve in between. And you want to change that balance at your marathon pace. As you get fit, your marathon pace is a relatively explosive pace. Even 7-minute mile pace, which, you know, to an elite runner doesn't sound like, oh, you're flying or anything.
Mm-hmm.
7-minute mile pace is a relatively explosive activity.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of people, it's a very explosive activity. And that's going to want to burn a lot of glycogen.
Right.
So you need to teach the body to burn less glycogen. So one way to do this is to just try to continue to run further and further distances. But the reality is to really embarrass the system, to really show your body there's a problem,
mm-hmm.
you're going to have to run 20 or 22 miles at that pace in a steady way.
Right.
Frankly, I can't run 22 miles at marathon pace in a workout. I don't know many people who can.
Correct.
And at that point, you're going to just be touching on the problem. So it becomes about transitioning the workout in a way that's going to make that happen. Whether it's if you're a real volume hog, I mean, one of the first great marathon-specific workouts that I've seen sort of looking back at running history is Kenny Moore would do a 30-mile easy run, as easy as 30 miles can be.
Right.
And then he would run 10K at his marathon goal pace, 6 miles at his marathon goal pace. Well, if you run 30 miles, your body's going to be pretty well out of glycogen.
Right.
So it's going to be careful to conserve glycogen no matter what pace you start running. And this would work. And Kenny was one of those guys who you never saw him fade at the end. He was always running the same pace coming in. I tend to look more towards repeats. So say maybe 20 to 25 kilometers, 12 to 15 miles of repeats at marathon pace with long but relatively quick breaks. So if you're a 7-minute miler, and so we're going to have you do 5x3 miles at 7-minute pace. That's your goal marathon pace.
Okay.
With 1 mile breaks at 7:30. So only 30 seconds a mile slower. That's
right. So that's really, not really a rest. That's
it's not
still,
really a rest.
Still moving
yeah,
pretty
exactly.
quick.
Exactly. And you're not going to enjoy it. You're going to feel like you're kind of doing a steady run, but it will give you just enough energy back. Because the reality is, 3 miles, the first 3 miles at marathon pace isn't going to be that hard. And then you're kind of like, oh, I got a little bit of a break. Of course, by the last break, you're like, that wasn't a break. I got hosed. This isn't fair.
coach is mean.
It's okay. If you're cursing Coach Jenkins out, that's fine. That's acceptable. But the reality is that's going to get you extra miles in. And it something about the shifting the pace gently teaches your body to run the faster pace in a very similar energy expenditure way as it was running the slower pace. And the chances are at 30 seconds slower per mile, that's going to, then your marathon goal pace, you probably already burned glycogen efficiently enough to get you through a marathon. But the big thing about doing this is small changes go a long way. So if you're at my weight, you burn maybe 140 calories a mile running. And that's pretty consistent across the speed, small differences. If you're, say, naturally, you burn 120 of those glycogen at marathon pace and 20 from fat. If you can make a difference in training and teach your body to burn 20 less, so now it's 100 in carbs, 40 in fat. Well, over 20 miles, you're going to get an extra 400 calories to play with. Well, at 140 calories a mile, you've got almost 3 miles there that you found with just that small shift. It's difficult to eat. You know, if you figure the wall is at 20 or 22 miles, leaving you with 4 to 6 miles, you're looking at basically a deficit of carbohydrate that you need to make up of close to 1,000 calories. It's difficult to ingest 1,000 calories over the course of the race.
Right.
The other problem is your body is going to designate that those calories to go to your brain first, because your brain will shut off without carbs. And your body, as much as you want that marathon time, and you may say, oh no, I'm willing to go a little brain dead for this, your body will not agree to the deal. it just won't. So, and then glycogen is muscle specific, so you need to go to the right muscles. It's not just sitting, you might have enough carbs sitting in your gut, and as you get tired, your gut's going to shut down. Less and less blood's going to be going there. It's going to digest slower and slower. You can teach it to digest some, but the reality is you don't want to have to try to make up 1,000 calories just in fuel. If you need a 100-calorie boost, well, then a goo or a Gatorade, that's a good idea.
Right.
But the idea that fueling is going to somehow get you from your cracking at 20 miles to finishing with strength and power is just, it's not realistic.
Right, because you're saying for the most part, just to recap, because that was phenomenal. I think the way you explained that was really great. And for anybody that's listening or reading, go back and listen to that over again, because nutritionally, energy-wise, for the marathon, Nate just nailed it. But yeah, so going back to that, so you need, in terms of, you can't digest more, you know, you probably can't take in the total amount of calories that you need to
make
refuel.
Up the gap between the glycogen stored in your legs
right.
and the glycogen needed to finish the marathon at your normal metabolic rate at that pace.
Right. And I think a lot of people get it wrong because they just assume like, well, I can keep taking gels.
Yeah.
And the problem is that it, and as you were explaining, is the body won't digest it anyway. Like you can put them in, and you know, some of it will go, you know, some of it will be digested. First of all, you get some of it limited because it's not all getting digested or processed. And then once it is processed, once you get maybe that 50% of it processed, whatever, that's a made up number, but 50% of it processed, 20% of it's going to go to the brain because that's the first place that gets it to keep you functioning as a, you know, to thinking. And then now you only have 30% left, and then you just got to hope that 30% of that 100 calories that you got in through the goo actually goes to the running specific muscles. So you're talking about, you know, every goo you take, maybe only 30 calories of it actually going towards, you know, your marathon pace or your ability to continue to run. And as Nate said, you know, you're probably going to be about 1,000 calorie deficit. So you need about 1,000 calories. Obviously that's quite a few goos.
Yeah, it's just, it's not going to be sufficient to cover the problem. And it's not to say, one, you can train your body to digest more and to digest further into the race. And certainly, if you're going to run in the heat, you can also train it to take in a lot more fluid as you go in further the race. Steve Spence, the 91 or 93 World Championships, the ones in Tokyo, he reportedly could drink 13 ounces of water in a single sip.
Wow.
And he drank so much during the marathon, which is still the highest heat index they've ever had for a championship marathon, be it Olympic or world championship. He drank so much that he actually had to pee as soon as he finished, and he was peeing during the race because he was taking in so much fluid.
Wow.
Well, that's impressive that his body could, one, take it in, and two, process it. I mean, I've run a heat marathon. It was rough. I trained and practiced taking in fluid, and I still couldn't get to that point. But you can teach the body to do some interesting things with that and get yourself a little more help. But the reality is the most direct way to fixing the problem is going to be teaching your body to burn more fat at that pace. And it's not – it isn't like it's a magic trick, like, oh, yeah, easily said. It's really easy to do. And there are probably – a dozen different kinds of workouts that will do this, whether it's the repeats at specific pace with the quicker rest, long runs, finishing fast when you're, you know, running your marathon pace or slightly quicker. One of the few times I'll ever say slightly quicker than marathon pace, when you've burnt a lot of glycogen, running close to but not quite at marathon pace, so say 10% slower for a significant amount of time. So go and warm up for 2 miles. And then run 25 miles at 90% of your marathon pace. That's a brutal, brutal workout. But if you're a very fit person, can handle long runs, and who hopefully has some people who at least run part of it with you to help you tow along, that type of a workout is an option. And then runs where you sort of vary the pace but keep touching on your marathon pace are also good for this. And if you live in an area where you can do it, if you do something like that, so let's say you do a run where you do maybe 10K at 80% of your marathon pace, which would be comfortably quick.
Okay.
And then maybe you do 10K at marathon pace, 5K recovery, and then maybe another 10K at marathon pace. So now you've done 35 kilometers, which is a good long run. If you can finish with 5K, you know, another 3 miles uphill. So if we were doing this in miles, just think instead of 10K, 6 miles, you know, 5K, 3 miles. So you're now at like 21, 22 miles. If you run another 3 miles uphill, max effort, uphill burns carbohydrate calories like it's going out of style. That's going to want to swing you to 100% glycogen burning. But you're so tired, your body's going to fight that and resist it. And it really teaches your body, embarrasses the systems, and says you need to keep more glycogen in our system for this length of time. Excuse me. So if you can do that, you're really, you're going to see results. You really, really are. And I honestly, if you figure out your paces and you look at your half marathon best, if you're running more than 5% slower for your marathon, which I would say 90% of the people I talk to are, you really need to change how the marathon workouts that you're doing.
Yeah, so that's actually probably a pretty good way for people to determine, you know, where their weakness might be in the marathon. And as you said, most people, that's the case. But a good way is to just say, you know, what's my half marathon time? And then you add 5% and double it. And if that's faster than their marathon time, then their problem is more than likely related to burning too much glycogen or not being efficient enough at burning fat as a fuel source.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, that's cool. That's a great way for people to kind of determine where they may be able to improve. And I like those four workouts that you gave as examples for people to kind of implement, you know, workout long run type deals. So in terms of going into the nutrition thing a little bit more, you said you can train your body to do it. Is there any specific way other than just continuing to try to, force yourself to eat and drink?
Well, I think that a big part of it is it's practicing forcing yourself to eat and drink. There are a few small tricks that are important that anybody could do and everybody should do prior to their marathons. The day before, you want to keep all your meals to 700 calories or less. I don't care if you eat, I don't know, a bucket of pure carbohydrates, whatever it is. After 700 calories, it's fat because your body can't process it as glycogen quick enough, so it's got to change it into fat and store it as fat, which does you no good the next day. So eat a lot of small meals of 500, 600 calories over the course of the day, and you can really load up a lot of extra glycogen into your muscles and into your system. Now, some of that glycogen is going to get loaded into the muscles in your arms, and it's not going to do you any good on the race day. But if your arms are loaded with glycogen and you're taking a goo during the race, your arms aren't going to steal any of the any of the carbs from the goo. So, I mean,
Okay.
it's not necessarily ineffective, plus there's no way to avoid it. So the second thing is you don't want to eat for the 4 hours before the marathon. I don't even want you drinking a Gatorade. Nothing with calories in the 4 hours before. So
Interesting.
get up early, eat a good breakfast, but 4 hours. And this one, I think your body goes into a little bit of its conservation, starvation mode. Now, you're not doing much in those 4 hours, so you're not burning any energy. So don't worry about it. It's just your gut's going to be empty, which tells your body, hey, we don't have a lot to work with here. Be a little more efficient.
Interesting. I've never actually heard that theory before.
I hadn't either. I did it for my marathons all on accident. If I eat within 4 hours of a hard race, I get to have that again later. So I'm not. I didn't do it on purpose. But I had seen a thing where Joe Riho was talking about it, and then when I was on the World Championship team, and they gave us our prep on how they want us to fuel and stuff, it was one of the things that people from the University of Georgia really harped on that they had for talking about the fueling. So
Interesting,
then,
because I'm sorry, I'm just going into that, because like I said, for a lot of marathoners, I mean, their biggest question is, should I take a goo? I mean, I think if you looked at a starting line of a marathon, like a minute
it's a
before the gun went off,
goose.
you'd see people like downing goos like there was no tomorrow.
Yeah, drinking the Gatorades, their special mixes. Yeah, no, wait until 5K. Next, in terms of prepping yourself, you want to think about your race and when you're going to be able to take fuel. Some people have a spouse or a friend who is just indefatigable and, outrageously accommodating, who will meet them every mile somehow, or ride a bike next to them, I don't know. And in that case, sure, you have unlimited options to go for it. But most people, even at an elite level, they tell you before the race, every 4 miles, there will be a stop and this is what will be there, or your bottle will be there, or every 3 miles, whatever it is. So then in your training, you want to practice taking fuel at those breaks in every long run, every single long run, I don't care how easy, and every specific workout. Every time you're running marathon pace, if you're going to be getting a Gatorade every 5K, I want you drinking a Gatorade every 5K. Get used to that rhythm. Teach your body that that's how fuel comes in and this is what you'll have to work with on the race day. And more than that, if that race gives out Powerade and you're going to be taking Powerade, drink Powerade in the workouts. If at all possible, drink the same flavor. Same thing with your goos. You take the goos and you try it. There are a few reasons for this. One, different people react to different things different ways. You don't want to take goos and find out that power gels that they're giving out give you diarrhea. You don't. That ruins 6 months of prep and it's just an unpleasant experience. But also, you want your body to be very used to those exact type of calories, and it will learn. Your body wants to succeed. Your body wants to improve. It wants to work. If you teach it what's going to happen, it will likely thrive. So I think that that's big. So a lot of it is just repetition of the same things. Personally, I was more of a water guy. I would only take anything with fuel, maybe once in a marathon, but it was unusual. For the most part, I would take a little bit of water, and that was it. The only coffee drinkers, you need to have something with caffeine somewhere between 15 and 20 miles. Whatever you have to do to get it, get it. You had your coffee 4 hours before the race. your system was juiced at the start at 4 hours out, you're good. Now you're 6 hours out, your caffeine is going to start to wear off in the 6th to 7th hour. You do not want that caffeine crash, which changes the rate you burn glycogen, which changes your mental outlook and aspect. It's just a bad thing. Somewhere between 15 and 20 miles, get some caffeine in, whether it's a goo with caffeine, whether it's flattened Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. It sounds stupid, but I will tell you, on my world championship team, three different people that I know of the five of us took flattened Coca-Cola late in the race. It works. It's got a lot of caffeine, and once it's flat, it goes down pretty easy despite the acidity. But whatever it is, if you can stomach black coffee late in the race, sure. I wouldn't have it hot.
Right.
Like nice. But whatever it is, you're going to need to get some caffeine in. If your body is used to having caffeine in its system, you need it. If you're not used to caffeine, I wouldn't do this just because it can make you jittery. It can make you throw up, that sort of thing.
Right. And I think it goes back to that whole, you know, don't do anything on race day that you haven't done before.
If you're not taking caffeine regularly. If you're not a coffee drinker, I don't drink coffee or caffeinated tea anymore. I still do the day of races before. If I was going to do a marathon, I would actually, drink something with caffeine late in the race. But I know my stomach handles it. Mm-hmm. So I would experiment with it in training first.
Cool. Great. Those are some fantastic tips. I mean, I think you are spot on in terms of, you know, getting people prepared for the nutritional and physical aspect of the marathon. I think they go very hand in hand. So I think that was really helpful. Kind of closing in, I guess probably maybe the last big question. And I like to ask this to a lot of the former elite runners that we have on the show. You know, if you could go back to your 22-year-old self, what would you say? You know, what was the biggest mistake that you feel that you've made in your training or your build-ups or, you know, kind of whatever? What would you change?
You know, this one's, for me, I think a lot of people have to really think about this. This one for me is extremely easy. There are two things and two things only. One, my marathon career was essentially ended by a herniated disc in my back, which was from poor posture, but more or just weak core strength. I hate the gym. I hate cross training. So I didn't do any. I would say, you know, don't be a jerk. 4 minutes a day of pedestal is not going to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for those of you who don't use pedestal, it's a routine of abs that's just off of a plank,
right.
Basic series. That would be the first one, because I really felt like I left my best fitness years. I wasn't able to run a marathon because of it. I've since had surgery. I'm hoping at some point the nerve damage in the leg will sort of right itself and I'll be able to get back out there. But that would be a big one. The other thing is I have in the last few years seen how important touching on speed more regularly is. I would maybe do a set of strides each week.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that, you know, if you really looked at my schedule for the year, maybe it was 45 weeks out of the year. So you're looking at, you know, maybe 50 sets of strides over the course of the year. I would massively change that. You should be touching on speed all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I loved Joe Beal's got an article about Dina Castor getting to the bronze medal and called Anatomy of the Medal. And he mentions in that essentially for 4 years after she got out of college, they did something for speed every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically took her 3K pace and made it her 10K pace in a 40-year span. If I had managed to do the same thing, I would have run sub 28, which I didn't come anywhere near. So I think that is important more than anything else. It improves your efficiency over all distances, but also it really improves your injury prevention and durability. And I think I could have run a lot faster at 5K and 10K had I been doing that. Even touching on it, you know, I started kind of doing it when I was, you know, more maybe 28, 29 years old when I started to realize that my minimal speed that I had was disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
And it made huge differences. And I ran the best, you know, 5K and 10K of my life off of not impressive cycles.
Yeah.
you know, and so I think that's a huge, huge thing. And it was the area I think that I missed more than anything else. I did a tremendous job of developing my aerobic system from sort of all angles, but I didn't develop the chassis. I didn't develop the muscular system to go with it. And I think I left a lot of time on the table because of it.
Yeah, oh, I'm glad you brought that up because that's something I probably feel a little bit about myself as well. And I think a lot of it's just been the way training theory has changed over the last 10 years or so. But I feel the same way. And I think when athletes, so I write strides into a lot of the schedules that I build, and I see them a lot in just schedules in general. And I think it's something that a lot of athletes skip over. And I think that even goes to the core work that you were talking about, the core, the pedestals, you know, those types of things. I think athletes see those on the schedule and they see the run and they say, okay, I got my run in, and the strides and the core, it all just kind of seems like extra, like, I'll do that, you know, I'll do that when I can or when I'm on vacation. And I think it's good to point out that it's important and it's there for a reason. You know, those
yeah,
types of things,
absolutely.
And going back, it can be a big, big boost.
Yeah, I think looking back, I looked at a schedule and I thought, you know, there's 150 miles here. That's priority one. Priority two is going to be whatever workout is on the schedule. You know, there's probably one workout that's maybe a bit bigger. Then priority three is the next hard effort, you know, or maybe the long run, whatever. And that strides and core stretching, that stuff was all sort of, well, hopefully I get that done. But, you know, hey, it's real life. And everybody, I don't care how you're doing it, things get missed. Things are going to fall by the wayside. If I were, when I look at my schedule now, I say, okay, this schedule, number one priority is going to be that I touch on the speed. That's the number one priority. If my miles for the week are a little bit lower, now part of that too, I've got a heck of a lifetime base at this point. So mileage in and of itself has become a little less important. But I would at least say that if I was going back in time, then of equal importance would be touching the speed and the muscular stuff. Your aerobically, I see this a lot where you see kids come into a college system that doesn't do a lot of speed, but it's a big jump in their mileage. And you see them, their fitness overall improve massively, but their times on the track only improve incrementally because they're losing. They came from a high school program that was all speed all the time, which I'm against, but is tremendous muscular work. And so now they're getting muscularly weaker while they're getting aerobically stronger. There's no reason for it because you can do most muscular work alactic, you know, in bursts of less than 15 seconds. It won't tire you out. If anything, it'll make you feel better. And on top of that, it's when it's combined with the aerobic work, the rate of improvement can just be startling. It really, really can. If there's a, you know, a quote unquote magic bullet of training, I think it's the balance of those two things, and everything else is the frosting.
Right.
It's delicious, but you don't need it till the end.
I like it. So yeah, talk a little bit about now. You kind of mentioned it briefly, but talk about kind of what you're doing now. Like, I think you're, yeah, I know you're training. Who are you running for? You know, those kind of things.
Yeah, so I'm running for Race Menu. It's a running startup that's basically different ways of for races to create a social media aspect, but also just do their entries and sort of the day-to-day stuff like that. It's been a really neat experience. They're a fun group of guys. It's definitely a group you could appreciate. Is they're just sort of you know, they saw a need in the sport and decided let's go get it, and we can do this better than other people in a different way, and bring a lot of nice new fresh ideas to it. And they've been great, been really supportive.
If people were signing up for, like, they use races and stuff. So if people were signing up for a race, like a local 5K or something like that, Race Menu would help with the entries.
What they do is if you're putting on your local 5K, you can hire them to be in charge of your online registration and that sort of thing. They do a couple of other things around that, and I know they're expanding out to other areas. If you live in the Northeast, you've probably signed up for a race that they do.
Okay.
They do a lot of the races up here. Sometimes you'll realize it because you found it through their website, which has, you know, all their races and a lot of other events and stuff going. Other times you may not have even realized. you know, it's one of those things. They've got some neat ideas with how to tie entries into social media and stuff like that, which is fun. A lot of just different, the little fun things that I guess you don't really appreciate until you get them. It was like chip timing.
Right.
No one really thought anything of it until all of a sudden the guy who was you know, had been losing 30 seconds every time he started a local 5K because he started at the back, realized he just got a 30-second PR because someone put his chip mat at the start. This is wonderful, you know. And now I don't care what race you go to, there'll be someone in the background of that little high school 5K complaining that it's going to take him 3 seconds to get to the line from the third row and there's no chip mat down, you know. So I think someday we're going to all expect that our result instantly pops up on Facebook the moment we cross the finish line and things like that.
Very cool. Very cool. And so what else? Anything else? I think I kind of interrupted you there as you were going on.
I've been able to work out a deal where while running for Race Menu, I'm competing for a club for the first time since my first marathon. So I'm running for the Central Mass Striders, which is a lot of fun. They were They're a really fun group of guys, and I grew up in central Massachusetts, and so always sort of idolized some of the guys who are now on the Masters squad.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been fun to have a team again. And there's a reason to show up for a race when you're not in the best form and just be like, I've got to pick up some points for the team,
right.
Which I like. I like that aspect of it, particularly at this point in my career where I'm not hitting the marathon and not really doing the stuff that I enjoy. It gives me an outlet that it makes running a 31-minute 10K worth it to me.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas it would just be something for me to write nasty, bad words in my log about.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's cool. I appreciate you, Nate, taking the time to talk to us about marathon training. I think, like I said, the information that you gave is phenomenal. Everybody's going to benefit from it. And we wish you the best of luck in terms of coming back and hopefully, you know, being able to race another marathon someday. And obviously kind of everything that you're doing, you know, with the 5Ks and 10Ks, you know, locally for now.
Yeah, thanks. I had a ton of fun doing this, and thanks for putting up with my long-winded answers.
No, it was great. It was great. All right, Nate, thanks so much.